Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. This week, have European astronomers struck dirt, as in pay dirt, as in the first planet outside our solar system that's made of the same stuff Earth is made of? We'll speak to a team member who says yes. Also, what color is an exoplanet anyway? If you guessed purple, you're probably right. We'll find out why. All that, plus a distant solar system where the planets make beautiful music together. We'll meet the woman who can name that tune. So stay with us, it's The Universe in Mind, the show that reminds you there's a whole world out there, and another, and another, and another, and another, and another. It's the discovery that a lot of people have been waiting for, the first planet outside of our solar system that's made of rock, a distant version of our own Earth. No one doubts that these rocky exoplanets exist. In fact, over the years, a handful may have already been observed by indirect means, but never with enough certainty to be sure. But all of that may have changed. Earlier this month, astronomers with Europe's Corot satellite announced they have a rocky planet in their data. The planet was discovered repeatedly crossing in front of a distant star, and the slight change in the star's brightness is what tells them this planet is the right size to be a rocky world. That's the good news. The not-so-good news is that the planet is so close to the star it orbits, its surface temperature probably exceeds 1,000 degrees Celsius, but we'll get to that in a moment. The finding was presented at the first Corot International Symposium in Paris. That's where The Universe in Mind caught up with one of the team members involved in the discovery. Malcolm Fridlund is the Corot project scientist for the European Space Agency. Dr. Fridlund, welcome to The Universe in Mind.
Thank you.
Now, this discovery by Corot is billed as the smallest exoplanet yet discovered. How small is it?
It's got a radius that's 1.75 times the Earth, so it's less than twice the diameter or radius of the Earth, and it's the first time we have measured accurately the radius of something that's this small.
So what does that mean in terms of what kind of planet this might be, to have a planet with such a small radius?
It means that it's with almost 100% certainty a planet of the same type as our own Earth, a rocky type of planet, and not a gas giant like Neptune or Uranus or any of the Jupiter or Saturn in our solar system. It's much too small for being that.
So I just want to make sure we understand the confidence with which you're making that statement. Is it that you cannot fit gas, a gaseous planet, into a volume as small as the diameter you're seeing of this planet?
Something as small as that cannot have the gravity to hold gas like hydrogen, helium, and methane like you have on Jupiter or so. The gravity would be too small, which means that it can't be enveloped. It can't be made out of gas. There's too little mass that you can squeeze into this volume to have the gravity to keep hold of a gas envelope. What we know about the mass of this object is that it's definitely smaller than 11 Earth masses and maybe as small as about 5 Earth masses, or maybe a little bit smaller. That we know from the follow-up radial velocity measurements. But nobody has measured the size of such a small planet before, and that means that this is the first time where we ever have been able to say that we will be able to say what this planet is made out of, because when we lock down the mass, which we will do within the next few weeks, we will be able to, with the diameter, to tell the density of the planet, and then we can say, we can already now exclude that the planet was made exclusively out of metals, like iron or nickel or something like that. It's not so massive, so it has to be a mix of at least metal and rock, or maybe even ices.
That's tremendously exciting, and so I want to ask you a little bit more about how you're going to nail down that mass. You said it's under 11 times Earth's mass, but could be as low as 5 times Earth's mass. That seems like a very
broad range compared to what we've heard in the past from other planets. Why is it such a wide range? Why is it so difficult to determine the mass of this planet? You have the size nailed down, it sounds like. Why is the mass so tough?
The mass is determined by taking the radial velocity of the star and showing how the star is moving back and forth by doing spectroscopy of the star. This star tends to be unusually noisy. It has lots of spots and faculae on its surface activity. Thank God it's rotating very slowly. It's rotating in the same way as our sun, so it rotates one revolution in 23 days. So otherwise it would have been even more difficult. But this activity creates a noise, and the only way to get rid of this noise is by keep observing it and beating the noise down by integrating up the signal. So we are currently observing it with the world's best spectrograph three times a night from South America at the European Southern Observatory there. And it's sort of refining the data continuously.
And it sounds like it's going to end up somewhere between that 5 and 11.
Well, it will end up closer to 5 than to 11. I can say that already now.
Wow. So what does that say, then, about the physical makeup of this planet?
It contains a lot of rock. It may be a little bit of ice, but it's a bit difficult to say exactly at the moment. It will demand several months of analysis to come up with models that sort of fit the exact density that we get. We also get a reasonable estimate of the temperature of the planet because we know how far it is away from its star. And taking all of this together, we will be in a good position in a couple of months to say what the planet is made out of.
Now, I think it's worth, for our listeners, it's worth clarifying the use of the word ice because, you know, we're talking about ice, but this is a planet that's also extraordinarily close to the star that it's orbiting around. So that kind of jars with the picture that there could be ice on this world. So can
yes.
you explain what you mean
I
by that?
I can understand that. The ice would have to be mixed up with the rock and be in the inside of the planet. There could be pools of water, but they would be continuously evaporating and would have to be sort of replenished from these ice that's below the surface. Who knows? I mean, it's very difficult. We've never seen an object like this before, and they have never been really hypothesized either. So we are finding something that's completely new, and we will have to analyze it further before we can say what conditions will be like. But it's not a planet where you will look for life, that's for certain.
Now, I think this find is quite a feather in the cap for Corot, this mission that has been, you know, that was launched specifically to look for these planets. There's another spacecraft on the way to the launch pad right now, NASA's Kepler spacecraft. You know, was there a sense of urgency to get this Corot discovery out into the public before Kepler?
Not really, because when Kepler launched, you know, we launched 2 years ago on Corot, and we have been collecting data ever since, and the satellite works perfectly. The problem is with these kind of observations that everything out in space, all the stars we are looking at are variable. They vary at this level we are looking at the one part in 10,000 level. And therefore, the follow-up analysis takes an enormous amount of time. And since Kepler is going to have exactly the same kind of problem with interpreting their data, the data that's similar to this is a couple of years in the future, and therefore we didn't really feel an urgency. So we have sort of just been preparing things the way we have done. The urgency in releasing this data was basically because we had this conference planned, and we wanted to release it to our fellow scientists at this time.
Now, as you say, you've been working on this for over a year, but I just have to ask you, I mean, we live on a rocky planet. There are a few others in this solar system. What does it feel like to be part of a team that finally seems to have pointed out a case of another rocky planet out there elsewhere in the galaxy?
It's great. It's the high point of what I've been doing for my whole career. It's fantastic.
Well, it's hard to top that, so Dr. Fridlin, thank you so much for sharing this discovery with us.
Thank you very much.
Malcolm Fridlin spoke to us from Paris. Up next, the exoplanet revolution continues in living color. Adam Burrows is one of those scientists who likes to be where the action is. He's a theoretical astrophysicist at Princeton University, and he's well known as an expert in exploding stars. But lately, he's been turning his attention towards exoplanets, and in particular to hot Jupiters. These are gas giant planets that are thought to be similar in size and composition to Jupiter in our solar system, but they're much, much closer to the stars they orbit. The first hot Jupiter was discovered nearly 15 years ago, and it was a big surprise. Literally dozens have been spotted since then, so unlike rocky exoplanets like the one in our previous interview, we know a lot about hot Jupiters. We even know what color they are. Recently, I sat down with Adam Burrows to take stock of a rapidly growing field. Dr. Burrows, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now, hot Jupiters were the first exosolar planets to be discovered, these very massive planets very close to the stars that they orbit. And now we know even more about them because in some cases we've seen them crossing in front of the stars that they orbit. What can we say about the conditions on these planets that we couldn't have said when they were first discovered?
Well, that's an interesting question. We can first and foremost determine what their masses are. With transits, we can determine their radii. With radii and masses, you can determine densities and do some real physics because you're probing their basic structures. For instance, at a given mass, if you have a radius that is fairly large, you know that it has to be made predominantly of hydrogen. You can show that theoretically. So the observation of a small radius, maybe a factor of two smaller than the radius of Jupiter, which is eminently possible, would immediately indicate that the planet is mostly rock or heavier materials. And so these data say immediately by their fundamental nature, their zeroth order character, what the basic constituents of the object are. We can do more than that, though, because the apparent size of the planet is a function of its atmosphere. And in particular, at different wavelengths, depending on the absorption in the atmosphere, the apparent size can be different. If you can measure this variation in the apparent size of the planet, which doesn't have to be very large, it's less than a percent effect, you can actually get an ersatz spectrum of the planet without getting the planet's light. You're actually seeing the variation in the occultation of the star by the planet by dint of its variable atmospheric characteristics with wavelength. And so you can get a spectrum. In particular, you can see whether water's there or not. You can see whether there's carbon monoxide. We get emission and absorption features of many constituents, and we start really doing what's called remote sensing of these planets, but in realms and environments that are totally unlike any that we've encountered before. But we were able to get profiles in temperature and composition just as we can do for the Earth, just as we have done for Jupiter and Saturn and for the outer planets and their moons. And so it's quite exciting.
Now, talking about planets in our own solar system, obviously Jupiter and Saturn are quite far away from our sun. How, for these planets that are so much closer, how would the presence, that close proximity of all of that energy coming from the stars that they orbit, how does that affect these atmospheres? How does it make these planets different from Jupiter as we know it?
Yeah, the fundamental thing is if you get closer, for example, on average, these transiting extrasolar giant planets are 100 times closer than Jupiter is to the sun. You get an insulation, a stellar flux at the surface of the planet that's 10,000 times, going at this the square of the distance, larger than what Jupiter itself experiences. The net result is that whereas the temperature of Jupiter in its atmosphere is about 125 Kelvin, very cold, the temperatures in these atmospheres are between 1,000 and 3,000 Kelvin, much, much hotter. And it's by and large by dint of the proximity these planets enjoy, if I can use such a word. And so because they're close, they're very hot. Now, at these higher temperatures, you can get different chemistry. The water is steam in the atmospheres and is very prominent in these close-in giant planets. For Jupiter, water is in clouds and is at depth and is barely perceptible. For Jupiter, the clouds we do see are made up of ammonia, ammonia can't survive at these high temperatures in the atmospheres of extrasolar planets, certainly not as clouds. Could be in the gas phase, but even that would be problematic. So the clouds are very different in these extrasolar giant planets that are very close.
I suppose one of the other effects is that there would be quite a difference between the side of the planet that's facing the star and the side that is not. And would that temperature difference, I guess, the kind of the hot spot or the cold spot, would those extremes also make for a very different kind of atmosphere than we're used to seeing on Jupiter, say?
Indeed. And just focus on Jupiter for a second. Jupiter has a radiative convective boundary, a boundary between the radiative region that absorbs, where you emit mostly the radiation, the energy is transported mostly by radiation outwards, and the convective region where it's mostly by convection. That boundary is at about a half a bar, half an atmosphere. And it turns out to be close to the photosphere of Jupiter itself. And so the position where heat from the sun is deposited. So a lot of the heat from the sun is deposited in this general region and below this boundary. What relevance this has is that you can deposit directly heat into the convective region, and if it's convective, then that convection redistributes the heat all over the planet. And so the stellar irradiation in Jupiter can be shared by many of the latitudes and longitudes of Jupiter, even on the night side. The night side won't be optically the same, but in the infrared it'll be very similar, and this has been measured. So the day side and the night side of Jupiter are fairly similar because you can absorb into the convective zone directly the stellar light. With these close-in planets, and as you move the planets closer in from Jupiter to 100 times closer, you change the position of the radiative convective boundary because you change the character of the atmosphere. And you can show that that boundary gets deeper and deeper. And what that does is you can't get the Jupiter effect where the irradiation actually is redistributed by dint of global convection that you tap or that you penetrate, into which you penetrate, to redistribute all that heat to from the day side to the night side. What that says is that in the infrared, we already have this in the optical because of the difference in reflection on the day and the night side. In the infrared, the emissions can be very different for these close-in planets. So different, we don't know what the differences are, but that's going to be an extreme contrast, which you don't experience in Jupiter, you may well definitely will experience with these close-in extrasolar giant planets. And so the meteorology, which this is related to, the morphology of the winds and the temperature distributions with latitude and longitude are bound to be very, very different.
So we see a lot of artists' conceptions of what some of these planets might look like, and I'm wondering, putting together all of the constraints that you've described and the different effects that you've described, I mean, could you paint a picture for us of what it might be like to actually be nearby one of these hot Jupiters? What kind of a world would it look like?
Well, that's a good question. A lot of people ask it. Of course, I don't want to be too nearby without comfort. Again, we're very, very close to the central star, and under normal circumstances, our spaceship wouldn't really survive very long. But that aside, you ask the question what the spectrum of the emission might be, and it's going to vary with latitude and longitude. It'll be different in the day and the night side, but by and large, in the optical, they could look rather purple. Now, there would be dim purple. And what their look is depends on the contrast between their background and their actual emissions, and so that's an optical effect. But by and large, they can look purplish if you could determine them, if you could activate the cones in your eyes, which you would be able to at that distance.
And what is the source of the purple color?
Well, you have, in the optical, you're going to have some reflection, and the reflection is larger for the shorter wavelength, so you start bringing up the blue. In the middle of the optical, you have absorption by the sodium D line. There's still sodium there, and that's by and large absorption. And so you don't have yellow. And then you have what are high temperatures, but they're still low compared to the surface of the sun. And the sun is sort of white-yellow. And so what you have is, as you go to longer wavelengths, the fluxes go up very fast. The flux goes up to the red, is a minimum around the yellow, and then there's a blue component. So you have red plus blue, and that's purple.
Now, this field, by any standards, is exploding rapidly. Many young researchers are coming into the field. Where do you see things moving at this point? It seems to be going so quickly. How much more will it grow, and what directions will it be taking?
Well, that's also a difficult question. We didn't anticipate how soon we'd be getting information such as we have. Things are exploding, as you say. People are finding techniques they can employ on the ground. There are more people studying this, so we get more results. Even large telescope time is being devoted in no small measure to this project. So there are space-based assets. The excitement that's been generated and the discoveries to date will certainly encourage people to look seriously at this field in the future. So much so that in the next few decades, this century's first few decades, are going to be a golden age for planetary discovery and characterization outside the solar system.
Adam Burrows, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
My conversation with Adam Burrows was recorded last month at the annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society in Long Beach, California. During the meeting, I heard Burrows comment that the average age of researchers studying exoplanets is now dropping. That's because the area is so hot and advancing so rapidly that young scientists are flooding in huge numbers. If you've ever wondered what a revolution looks like in science, I think we're seeing it. Now, from seeing to hearing, here's something you can try if you've got a piano around the house. Strike a note in the middle of the keyboard like this, then one octave higher, and then again one octave higher. Okay, it's not much of a tune, but it is a resonance. These three notes seem to reinforce each other because the second note vibrates exactly twice as fast as the first, and the third note vibrates twice as fast again. Well, believe it or not, there may be a solar system out there that's doing something very similar. Last November, astronomers in Canada revealed one of the first direct images of planets orbiting around another star. In fact, they found three planets in total, and they looked just like you'd expect, tiny little dots circling around a much, much brighter star at the center. But now it seems there's something odd about the way they're circling. To find out more, I spoke with Ruth Murray Clay of the Harvard-Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Ruth Murray Clay, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't we start with a profile of this planetary system? Obviously, because it's been imaged now, it's very exciting. You can actually see a picture of these planets. But can you give me a portrait of this system? What are these planets like? How would they compare to our solar system?
So these planets are actually in some ways very similar to our solar system and in other ways quite different. I'll start with the similarities. There are three of them, three giant planets, all on orbits that look like they might be close to circles going around a star in a planetary system. So this is different from a lot of the systems that have been discovered so far because there are a lot of planets. They're all together. And if you scale the system up in mass and size, then it actually looks very similar to our solar system. And the big difference comes from what I just said. These planets are orbiting a star that's about 1.5 times the mass of the sun, and the planets themselves are actually about 10 times the mass, probably, of the planets in our system. So it's a giant solar system.
So it's our solar system supersized. Now, of course, it's exciting to actually see these planets in an image. But what is it about this system that interested you in particular?
Well, what my collaborator, Daniel Fabricy, who's also a postdoc at the Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, and I were most interested in was the fact that these planets do seem to be so massive. And so if you look at their orbits around their star and you just take them at face value, it turns out that they're actually so big that they'll interact with each other very quickly and potentially cause the whole solar system to fly apart on very short timescales, much shorter times than the age of the system. So that doesn't seem realistic because we'd have to be extremely lucky to see them in the process of flying apart.
It almost sounds to me like you're looking at a cosmic house of cards. Just the slightest little breath would knock the solar system apart.
That's right, and that's exactly right. And so since that's probably not what's going on, the universe doesn't generally generate houses of cards, probably instead the orbital structure of this solar system is a little bit different from what you would think at face value. So that's what we did. We tried to figure out what orbits these planets should have to make them stable.
So how do you set about doing that? How do you figure out how a solar system could be stable when it seems, as you said, that it would fly apart easily?
So what we have to do is consider all of the possible orbits that that these planets could have given the observations. So these observations are over the course of about 4 years, but the orbits of these planets take hundreds of years to complete. So actually the data is just giving a very tiny piece of the orbits, and it's not entirely clear what the full orbits are yet. So there are many possibilities to try. In fact, there are too many possibilities to really just look at every single one. So we had to be a little bit clever and go through them systematically. But when we did that, we found that in order to be stable, these planets have to be in what's called a resonance with each other. So they have to, each of the planets has to orbit, the inner planet has to orbit 4 times around the star in the same time that the central planet orbits 2 times around the star. And in fact, you get an even better answer if in that same amount of time, the outer planet orbits once around the star.
So if I'm understanding correctly with these really nice round numbers, the outer planet, every time it goes around exactly once, the next planet in goes exactly twice, and the next planet in, the one that's closest, goes 4 times around?
Yeah, so that's the idea. And as you said, that's a very special sort of situation. And you might be extremely surprised to find planets in that special situation. And it turns out that you can get configurations like that in our solar system, in the Kuiper Belt, and they're in resonances like this with Neptune. So Pluto, you know, our favorite former planet, is in what's called a 3-to-2 resonance with Neptune. Neptune goes around the sun 3 times every time Pluto goes around twice. And that's why Pluto can sometimes be closer to the sun than Neptune and sometimes further away, but never get kicked out of the system. That's why Pluto is stable.
So this 1-to-4 ratio, and the fact that you mentioned the word resonance, which is which we're used to thinking of as a musical term, how is it that this resonance would work and that these whole numbers would be so special in keeping the solar system together?
So the reason that a resonance is stable, that when two planets come nearest to each other, that's when they have the biggest opportunity to kick each other out of the solar system. And if that always happens when the planets are furthest apart in their orbits, then they aren't able to kick each other out as effectively. And so every time a planet goes once around in its orbit, it gets closer to the sun and then it gets further away. And so if these integer ratios are set up, then the planets can always become closest to each other when they are furthest apart from each other.
So assuming there isn't some, cosmic conductor that's set up this kind of musical solar system, how would the planets find themselves in this incredible pattern?
So again, we can appeal to what happened in our solar system to answer this question. And many Kuiper Belt objects, including Pluto, are in resonance with Neptune because Neptune migrated outward earlier in its lifetime. So it actually started much closer to the sun by about a third of its distance, current distance, closer to the sun than it is today. And it actually moved outward during the process of formation and caught a lot of Kuiper Belt objects into resonance. So if the similar thing happened in this extrasolar system, then perhaps these planets were formed at different distances from the star than they are today. And they all moved around and migrated, and during that migration process, caught each other into these resonances. And actually, when we look at other extrasolar planetary systems that have been found, many of them have what's called hot Jupiters in orbit around their stars. These are Jupiter mass planets that are at about 10 stellar radii from the star. And the only way people can think of to get them there is to have them migrate in a disk. So we actually do think that planets move around quite a bit after they're formed.
And in this case, they moved into this, they slotted into the groove, so to speak, and they've stayed that way ever since. So I guess that suggests if they hadn't found these resonances, this solar system would have fallen apart, but here's a way that it can survive.
Does that mean there could be, I mean, what are the implications? Does that mean there could be more planetary systems because they can exploit these this kind of zone of stability?
Yeah, I think that is what that means. It means that massive planets might be able to form in a lot of systems, and instead of kicking each other out and ending up with just a few planets left, maybe those planets can find these stable zones and form planetary systems that have a lot of planets in them. I think that this discovery of these planets is very exciting because looking around these higher mass stars, there will probably be a lot more of these systems found in the near future.
Well, that's great. We're certainly looking forward to hearing more from this exciting field. Ruth Marie Clay, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ruth Marie Clay is a theoretical astrophysicist with the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. And for the record, the musical planets she was speaking about are with the star HR 8799. And speaking of music, the music you're hearing now is telling us that that's all we have time for this week, though no doubt there will be more exoplanets to talk about in the future. The Universe in Mind is brought to you by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto, and you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. Kathy Parrott is our online producer, with support from Hugh Zhao and Angela Choi. Our cover art was created by Efahan Elby, and it features the work of Bettina Forget. I'm Ivan Semenek. Be sure to check in with me next week for more news and conversations about the world of astronomy. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind. Thanks.